sure.
Just give me your cell phone.
And then they have insurance. Now
okay.
Is more.
Let's call this meeting to order.
Us.
And do we have a motion for approval of the agenda?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Approval of minutes?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Let's have any reports that we need. We've been working from my perspective on the cities and have been moving forward with that. I have now given presentations to 5, I think, of the 6 cities. And just did one to City of Vancouver last night. It's been a wonderful opportunity to interact with the cities and let them know what is up with the Commission on Aging and what we're about. And at least the City of Vancouver was glad to have somebody come back again because it's been a couple of years. And what we are now in the process of doing is creating task forces in each of the cities to sort of carry the ball in relationship to aging issues for their cities, because each one has unique needs and foci, and so we want to just help facilitate that as best we can. And we realized very quickly that in some ways our commission is too Vancouver-centric, and that's something that we have to be thinking about going forward. I'm the only person on the commission not in the City of Vancouver. When somebody from the Battleground City Council said, "And how many of you are from North County?" And I said, "You're looking at him." It was a little awkward of a moment. And we want to represent the whole county, not just a part of the county. So that's something we need to think about going forward. Bob, do you have anything specific?
No, I have nothing special.
Okay. Marjorie is out of state visiting a terminally ill brother. Treasury report, Chuck, anything specific?
Nope, still the same.
Nothing changed?
Nothing has changed.
Impact, Karen?
This report will be short, but it will...
Mike?
This report will be short, but it will bring you up to date on what has been done since last I reported last month. We have made plans to give a time banking presentation to the North Salmon Creek Neighborhood Association and also to Rose Village, and those two presentations will take place later this month. Our impact is going to be given just a few minutes of time at the Circle of Giving on Thursday to just let people know that it's a new program in Clark County, that it does exist, and we'll be able to spread some literature about our impact while we're there. A couple of weeks ago, we met with Columbia Ridge Assisted Living, and we're excited about the partnership that we're going to have with them. They are going to be doing on October 7th at 3 p.m. in the afternoon a happy hour, kind of an Oktoberfest mini-themed event. And it's going to be for their partners, so that we will have an opportunity to introduce our impact, the Clark County Time Bank, to the folks that they work with on a regular basis. So we're really, really excited about that. And they are going to be one of our information hubs in the Camas Washougal area, because there are only a few of us, and one of the things that we're looking to do is to identify people within the various communities within Clark County that are excited about and supporters of the Time Bank program that can kind of spread the word and give out information to their community, because we cannot be in more than one place at a time And we are a merry band, only a very few people. So we're looking for partners to help us spread the word, and we're very happy to have Columbia Ridge as one of them.
Are you doing something with Boomerang as well?
Not anything on a formal basis, but yes, they're a great supporter of all of the community,
right.
Various projects that are going on. There was an excellent article about our impact in the Reflector in Battleground two, three weeks ago now.
Yeah.
And we are going to be doing a presentation November 18th at 6:30 p.m. at the Battleground Public Library. And again, the library in Battleground will be a great information hub for us. So there'll be information there, hard copy information. Of course, they have the computers there, so if someone doesn't have a laptop or computer at home and wants to become a part of the Time Bank, they can always go to the library and join through that, and also have the opportunity to ask some questions or get a little bit of help if they need that to get on the computer. Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll give you all. Yeah. Oh, super. Yeah. And if you would like us to make a presentation to the fitness group out there, we would love to do that too. Yeah. We'll go anywhere and talk about the program. We love it. So thank you for that. We're going to be attending the Camas City Hall meeting on Thursday of this week, in line with what we're doing with the cities. So that's kind of the latest and greatest on our impact for the month. And once again, next month, we'll give you the skinny on what's been happening over the past 30 days. So that's it for the Time Bank.
Okay. Chuck? Something on housing?
Well, the big exciting news for us is that with the Parade of Homes...
Turn your mic on. Is it on?
Hello. Is that working now?
Yeah.
Okay. I really don't need this, you know.
Yeah.
With the Parade of Homes, we... we'd been working with the BIA, which is the Building Institute Association, here in Portland for
Vancouver.
What did they say?
Portland.
Well, did I say Portland? that's kind of where how my day's been going. Where am I not right now?
Yeah.
In Vancouver, thank you. For a number of years now then with getting a home in the Parade of Homes. And finally this year we did. This afternoon or this morning I was able to get out and visit John Taylor, who is the builder, and look at the home and chat with him about that. About his home, and it is very nice. For $639,000, it's a pretty cool house. So, and it's actually, believe it or not, it's one of the smaller homes out there at about 2,600 square feet or so. So, four bedroom, three bath. But it has a pretty unique design to it, and he's really looking forward to doing more of the same kind of design and build here in Vancouver area. He's a builder who lives in Vancouver. I thought he lived over in the Portland area, but anyway, so we got that going on, and then also. Another meeting we had, I had with Colette, was with the CVTV, is that right? I always get that backwards. CVTV, and we are going to be working with them with doing a short little video on aging in place for them. It's going to be about 3.5 minutes or so, maybe. And so we're going to be getting two or three people, and then we'll also be doing some video of probably of John Taylor's place and a couple other homes, and then some quick interviews in that 3.5 minutes. So that's basically about the two big things that are kind of going on, and our group is working on a number of other things. So
for anybody who wants to see a totally accessible home, you should go out to the Parade of Homes. The one he's talking about is completely accessible in every place. It's got two master bedrooms that you can roll into the showers and
it has a shower room that is
the size of this room.
Yeah, you can get lost in that. You need an arrows to get out of it. So direction arrows to be able to get out of it and everything. But nevertheless, very cool for $639,000.
Okay, thank you, Chuck.
You bet.
Nomination of treasurer. Somebody want to nominate treasurer?
I nominate Charles for the sector for treasurer.
I second.
All those in favor?
Wait.
Done. Done. Thanks, Chuck.
Question.
We already essentially gave the city meetings update. Just to say that they have
How
been...
How did this happen anyway?
They have been exceedingly open to us and very accommodating, and people have asked really good questions, and... we were saying that yesterday in Vancouver, it was the most engaging of all of the cities. Ridgefield was awfully good too, but boy, oh boy, City of Vancouver, those people were on it. I was impressed. Yeah, let's just say that. And obviously they have different slants from one another, but boy, they were good questions. It was a wonderful give and take. They're all very open to the idea of having task force to help them out. And, they all know they're facing huge issues and aren't thinking about it.
You know, Bill, I'm very excited about this, about us doing this, because I think, like for me, going to Ridgefield, it's going to be a different take on what's going on with them. You know, they've got a lot of different things going on out there, a lot of expansion happening, and all of that. So it's going to be very different from Vancouver or some of the other places and everything. And I think what's really going to be exciting is for us here to hear, get reports.
Yes.
You know, to understand more about what's kind of going on with the different cities too, because I don't know.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, I know that, you know, obviously, Vancouver is the big dog on the block, and yes, they have issues and a lot of things going on and all of that. But, you know, how are we going to interact with that and be a part of that? That's all going to be very interesting.
Linda, what was your feel at last night? Questions and so forth.
I was impressed with the fact that they had questions on a variety of areas, from transportation, and they had and comments, good comments, from all of the areas that the aging plan addressed, it seemed. And almost all of the counselors asked a question, so I felt like they were really open and for this to happen, for us to have these task forces.
Yeah, it was very strong. And the cities are so different, and there are issues that each of them is going to have to face with aging. If you take one of the things, I know when, Colette, you were there when we did Camas, and one of the things that Camas and Washougal is very intriguing to me they have to become Vancouver-centric unless they change that. And that becomes problematic long-term. If you go to Battleground in a two-mile area going from south around, you've got Legacy, Peace Health, Providence, Vancouver Clinic, Albertsons, Fred Meyer's, Safeway, Walmart, theaters, restaurants, all of it's right there. Once you get past 192nd, you got a couple of Safeways. And that's a lot of people, and that's a lot of driving, and we know as we address that in aging, that becomes more and more and more and more problematic. And so it's an issue that those cities are going to have to be thinking proactively about. I mean, Camas, what's the size difference between Camas and Battleground? They've got to be really similar.
Camas is about
1,000 more. Okay. Wow. There's a Red Robin coming to Battleground. I mean, come on. This is really upscale. Full disclosure, I'm from Battleground. So. But anyway, the city meetings have been great. We've loved them. Looking forward to the rest. Okay, let's move into the presentation.
I have a motion that I would like to make.
What's that?
In our bylaws, it talks about the fact that if a person is absent from the council meetings four times in a row, that they would have to remove themselves. And so the motion is that we have a vacancy on the commission.
Yeah. So you moved to vacate her position?
I moved to vacate the person.
Okay. Second?
Second. I second that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. That's all you need to send that message, right? Okay. Jose, we are excited to hear what's happening with the comprehensive plan and code work information. We'll find out shortly.
And Jose is looking very sharp today, by the way.
Do you want to introduce yourself and your title to those who are...
Jose Albers, I'm with the community planning, working with the group on the housing subcommittee. For the comprehensive plan, my assignment has been the housing element of the comp plan. Click the PowerPoint. So this is a sort of older presentation you see by the day, but this was sort of a broad overview that we gave to the board of Clark County Commissioners back in July to kind of let them know what the update of the comp plan would entail. And it's just, I was going to go through this quickly to give you some of the highlights. Next slide. So essentially the comprehensive plan started in Washington State because of the rapid growth that was occurring in the 1980s. You can see the amount of growth that occurred in Clark County in that decade, fourth highest in the state. Next slide. So Clark was mandated to fully plan, which when the legislature adopted the Growth Management Act in 1990, fully planning the difference between Wakalitz, Skamania, and Klickitat, they're mostly concerned with kind of critical areas of ordinances. Ours is just, there's 13 goals in the state plan that we have to address, from housing, affordability, to transportation, a lot of environmental, and so it's just a much broader depth look at how we are going to plan for growth in the next 20 years. Next slide. So the act was adopted in 1990. We had adopted the plan, our first comprehensive plan in 1979. That work was modified because of the change in state law that required that broader depth. So we completed our first comp plan in 1994. There was an update in 2004. and one in 2007, and we're scheduled to, we're required to complete the next update by 2016, June 30th of 2016. Next slide. So the, as it relates to housing, one of the biggest components that we have to look at is we get a range, a population range, from the Office of Financial Management, OFM. They give us a range of low, medium, and high of what the expected population growth is going to be in the next 20 years. Next slide. Next slide. So this is the range that we've got in 94, 2004, and 07, and how we've approached that historically. There's another slide that gives you the options that we were currently dealing with. Can you go to the next slide?
Jose, how many of those are going to be retired people?
Actually, there's a slide that estimates that.
Okay. We'll get there, Bob.
Next slide. That's just showing you the growth that's occurred over time. Next. There we go. As of 2010, the population of the county is about 425,000. We're getting close to about 448, 450 now. So the range provided by OFM, you can see in the last three columns, the board did end up choosing something close to the median. It's roughly 577,000, which would be about 125,000 increase over the next 20 years. The other sort of planning assumption that we use is an estimate of how many of those folks are going to live in an urban area versus the rural area. What we are currently planning for is 90% of that growth going to an urban area and 10% going to the rural area. Growth in that really tries to encourage development to occur in the urban areas where services are available. Those are policy decisions, but just for some context, in 1994, when we first adopted the plan, the assumption was 81-19, essentially an 80-20 split between urban and rural. In 2004, that was updated to a 90-10 split. We're probably, I was just looking at the data from 1995 to 2014, 11% of the growth that's occurred in the county has gone to the rural area. So we're pretty close to that target.
And how does that big discussion going on with the different alternatives fit into this?
So what typically we do, we have, can you go to the next slide? Here's your slide, Bob, for the population. So on the left,
there you go, Bob.
20.7% is expected to be 65 plus in 2035. It's a rather significant increase from the 11.5 that we had as a 2010 census.
And the most of those are people who are now 50.
Right.
Comes
exactly.
Not necessarily immigrants.
Correct.
No.
Well, but we do have, so the components of change, the change in population of the county are driven by two factors. It's the in-migration and then births over deaths. And most, the natural increase has been pretty flat, and the spikes that we get are from in-migration. And what a lot of that is, a lot of times people living within the Portland metropolitan region retiring and moving north. That's one factor. So you're going to see some folks who are 65 plus when they retire, don't want to get taxed across the river.
Right, exactly.
It totally makes sense. And you're still within the region. You haven't really moved too far. So I would expect that to continue. Next slide. Okay, so what typically what we have a vacant buildable land model where we estimate how much land we have and what we think is vacant and that we can build on. So we're projecting that we've got 8,000 acres of residential that are vacant that can accommodate about 147,000 folks in the urban area. So with the alternatives in the update, we typically have to show that we can accommodate the growth that is projected. When we look at the rural area, we haven't really had a vacant land model that we've used, which is sort of have a broad brush, kind of look at the number of lots that could be created based on the current zoning, and make sure that we have enough to accommodate the 10%. And we do have to do that. With the alternatives, there's a couple of alternatives that's increasing the capacity, and it's just kind of never been an issue. But in increasing the capacity, if those people do come, there may be impacts that need to be addressed, and that's what the environmental assessment is looking at. Next slide. So to give you some background on the building permits and single family, multi-family split, that's another component that we look at in terms of the Growth Management Act requires you to provide a diversity of housing type. We sort of accomplished that by having a requirement that no more than 75% of one housing type is built, which is typically single family is going to be the large component. So we try to have enough land to allow that diversity. In 1994, when we adopted the plan originally, that split or ratio was 60% single family, 40% multifamily. We reevaluated that in 2004 because a lot of the smaller jurisdictions weren't coming close to that with those targets. Next slide. So one of the things that we're doing is we sort of reorganizing the comp plan. I've got a handout for you. These are the goals and policies that are in the housing element of the current comprehensive plan. And what essentially we're trying to do is just kind of clean it up and make it a little more reader-friendly, and there's a couple of things that were just in the wrong location. I'm trying to clean up some redundancies. The other Word document. So on the page 2-27, there's a section in there that's talking about what the rural urban growth area, which doesn't really need to be in this, so I'm going to strike that from this. But this gives you an idea of what the goals are for the housing chapter, and then some of the policies that help implement it. I just wanted to give you an example. Some of these have been have been codified and put into code, and some haven't. And a lot of these policies have been in existence since 1994. On that first page 2-26, under policy 2.2.3, Park County shall create a voluntary inclusionary zoning program in residential and mixed-use zones with proposed incentive strategies. We haven't created that. That's not in our code. It doesn't exist. So those are some of the things that we're going to look at kind of in this go-around to have a discussion with the board about potentially coming up with some of these things and codifying them so we can put them to use. There's in here we also have one of the strategies is to use the accessory dwelling units, which is something that has come up. Currently, we have accessory dwelling units that are allowed in the urban areas, but not in the rural areas. And there's been some interest in pursuing that and seeing if we can't add that to our code to allow that to happen. We're trying to pull that into the comp plan update. We drafted some language to sort of amend the existing accessory dwelling unit language to allow it to occur in a rural area. There are still some things that need to be addressed. Like I said before, the comprehensive plan really tries to focus growth to occur in the urban areas. So right now, about 60,000 folks that are living in the rural area. So if we changed this to allow the zoning in the rural area to have accessory dwelling units, it's difficult to say how many new dwelling units would actually be created, or what kind of impacts that would have. So we have to do some analysis and try to gauge that in sort of an environmental assessment.
You know, one of the things that came up at our presentation to the counselors when we did our annual review, Counselor Stewart said that she was a part of the drafting of the ADU thing for the city of Vancouver. And she said one of the challenges was with higher density, you've also got parking issues and all kinds of stuff, whereas in a more rural setting, that would not be the problem.
Right.
And so, and ADUs are permitted in some of unincorporated Clark County and not in other areas of unincorporated Clark County.
Correct.
So there's a challenge with that.
And the difference, the two parts of unincorporated Clark County, one's urban and one's rural.
Right.
And so, there's that separation. I think on the ground, there, I don't think there'd be as much difficulty in having it in a rural area, but it's the policy implications of doing that are more, I think, the issues that we need to address. Or make sure that we've done our due diligence so that if we're challenged, we can show that there's some support.
Well, yeah, there, and from what she said, there were all kinds of issues that they had to address in the city of Vancouver.
Correct.
That was, it was just important to look at that stuff before the fact, and I agree
right.
with that.
And there might be less of those things in the
right.
rural area.
Yeah.
But currently there's some provisions in the code for similar type of development. I mean, it's
well, what's weird in some cases is you can have everything but a stove. Sort of, really? That's it? If I bring in a camper, I'll have a stove.
Right.
This makes no sense.
Yes, a guest house allows that without a kitchen. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. I agree.
Especially when the guys who then build them say, look, slide in the fake one and then take it out and put in the real one.
Yes.
And that's all over Clark County.
Yeah, I would say that's probably
the of course, out in East County, there is not going to be too much of that unless it's there. I'm going to be a 10-foot square house because the houses are all so close together and all those developments out there.
We're talking more about rural areas now.
Right, currently. So the issue with some of the smaller lots that we try to, we hope that we can address, a lot of those are multifamily zones. Multifamily zones for a long time have allowed single family detached homes, and in order to get into those 18 dwelling units per acre or 22 dwelling units per acre zones, they have to have really small lots. And from the development community, folks that I talked to, they think that's their way to provide some housing affordability. because they can't, the funding for building more traditional apartment style structures requires larger investment, whereas you can build these, you can either buy them as affordable housing, people buy them to rent them out, and it's just a different financing dynamic. So it's something that we need to look at and see if we can try to address that. But with all of, most of the land base in the county is 80% dedicated for single family and about 20% for multifamily. And so when you consume that small portion that you have for multifamily to continue allowing additional single family, when you have kind of issues with housing where people are being displaced, there aren't a lot of, you're essentially running out of that type of land.
But one of the things that from our perspective that we were concerned about is, like with the ADUs, we know that better than 50% of Americans who are approaching retirement have less than $110,000 in 401ks. We know that. We know that if they had to have any kind of in-home care, it's $41,500 a year.
Right.
And so, boom, they're out of whatever they had in their 401k and nothing flat. And let's say as they're aging, 87% want to age in place, which means they really want to stay where they are. And that's not always so easy. Well, especially if they have a ground to keep up or something. If they had a small place that could be rented out for less in exchange for keeping up the yard work or something, it would be a very symbiotic relationship. And the less we do that, especially right now, what do we have, 2% less than 2% vacancy in Clark County? It's terrible. And so the rents are jacked up, the people are thrown out, and so we're thinking there got to be other ways to fix this. And this is one of those ways that we feel like could be a win-win for everybody.
Right. I think currently we allow the hardship old homes on the rural area, and I think the argument would be, instead of kind of using the ADU as a model, sort of a more permanent sort of replacement for them, mm-hmm. that's, I think, the best argument we may have.
With all the tiny houses that are out now and all
exactly.
that stuff, yeah.
And then it would just, because once that hardship goes away, you have to dispose of that mobile home, you can't use it because we don't allow that yeah. second dwelling. That way you can make the investment and rent it out to someone else.
It
could be something
that
we could
generate
from
yeah.
that as well.
Yeah. Jose, along with housing, whenever we're talking about housing in the plan, are we also trying to look at the transportation piece along with the housing?
Yes.
I mean, both of those are kind of like hand in hand.
Right.
In my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, and so what we've done, if you look at some of our zoning maps, in terms of where we locate or sort of multi-family zone land, we try to put it as close to where we think there's either existing transit, like in Hazeldell, Highway 99 area, with the Highway 99 plan that we did. There's a lot of multifamily in that area, and it's well served by transit. And so when you have those areas that are being developed with single family, you get pushed further out. So when we expanded the urban growth boundary in 2007, it may not make sense currently to think that there's going to be multifamily north of 179th Street or in that general area. But in 20 years, growth will get there. But the challenge is trying to sort of have patient owners that are willing to wait for that And so that's sort of the tension that we're grappling with. You're not going to have, and that's not going to be the first thing that develops out there.
Right.
And transit's not going to be getting out there for a while. But the land is up for that, and it's just kind of a timing thing. And so that's what we're trying to balance though when we're looking at that.
So is C-Tran a piece of, I mean, how does that mix into all of this with what they are doing and where they are going with transportation, providing transportation?
So it's kind of...
Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot here.
We try to work together, but they can't serve population that doesn't exist, right? And so when we're looking out 20 years,
right,
they're looking at our plan to see where that growth is going to occur, or we think it's going to occur, so that they can plan accordingly.
Right.
This is a little bit different question. Out in East County again, talking with the neighborhood associations, a lot of those folks would like to age in place, but they're not sure that they want to do that in those houses that were built for their families.
Right.
So they're talking about, well, when I get to that point, I want to sell my house and I want a nice small house someplace. And I'm not sure that we're really thinking about a population that was looking for a 1,200 square foot house, Fairway Village type thing,
sure,
for retirees. And maybe that's, it's not in your realm, it's more in our realm,
right,
to try and stimulate that kind of construction.
Yeah, it's going to be, I know that there's, so the same story on something that builders are becoming more and more aware of, that there's a demand, firm demand for that, and I think that ties into, yeah, into that. And so the size of the home would also be something they look at. But you could also, you could still do a two-story, but how you design it so you have your master on the main floor is another way to do it. I was visiting a family, my wife's family in Texas, and her uncle was retired and designed his house as a two-story home. But then you've got the master on the main, and they sort of put the second, third bedroom upstairs for grandchildren and visitors, and it's really worked out well for them. But I mean, he really took ownership of that and designed it. I don't think it's very common in a lot of places, but it works really well.
And there's a lot of folks that are thinking about renting those two rooms up there.
Exactly.
You know, also today, I was out at the Parade of Homes, and I was just absolutely shocked when I got out there, and I drove around a little bit and saw all of the new homes, and all, not just the Parade of Homes, but other ones being built out in that area and everything. And so, and I asked one of the builders that I was visiting with, why does he like it over here? Because he used to be over in Portland. Now then he's over here as a builder. And he said, well, I can get more ground. Meaning that he can go and build bigger homes for more money.
Right.
You know, and so that's where these builders' heads are.
Right.
You know, I can, you know, I was, I just went, whoa, okay, that's very interesting. So, is there anything in the plan to help us with reducing that, let's call it an attitude, or probably not?
Well, we have, we've got our R15, R16, R175, R110, and R120 zones. So those are all 5,000, 6,000, 7,500, 10,000, and 20,000 square foot lots. And I would say the majority that we don't have a lot of R120 or a lot of R15. Most of what we have is in that R16 to R110, 6,000 to 10,000 square foot. The conversations I've had with the building industry is that the 5,000 square foot lot used to be sort of the entry-level home. And now it's more of those 3,500 square foot lots are entry-level homes.
3,500?
Square feet, yeah.
Wow.
And I mean, they're as small as 2,800. That's what Bob was referring to. And so the price, because of the cost of land, that's one of the trade-offs. So there's that. I mean, I think there's the concern I have is that those smaller lots are really being are consuming a lot of the land that we have in multifamily. I think something that we might want to do is look at and see if of the existing zoning that we have for single family, whether we need to create a new single family zone of maybe 4,000 or something maybe smaller where you can get that type of development to try to encourage more density in that way. Density is not a word people really like hearing, and it's there's just a variety of differences, and it's you look very cramped in a 2,800 square foot lot. That's very, very, very tight, given what we've seen historically. But you know, you could shape that into an apartment building, and so it's kind of how do you want to see that density laid out.
Can I ask a very simplistic question? And that is, Clark County Comprehensive Plan, how does that relate to land use of all the cities that are in Clark County? Who trumps whom?
So each jurisdiction has their own comprehensive plan and zoning ordinance. Our plans have to be consistent, but we don't have any jurisdiction over campus or Vancouver.
So this is only really a plan for unincorporated Clark County.
Right, in terms of land use. But we do have the coordination within our plans have to be jacked together.
Yeah, it's so weird because of how everything is gerrymandered, like with Hazel Dell.
Right. So I'll give you an example. In this plan, the density, the cities all agree to specific density guidelines that are targets. So the city of Vancouver, the Vancouver growth area has a target of 8 units per acre overall for their density as they grow. In the cities of Camas, Richfield, and Battleground use 6, and the center of Richfield, they're 4 dwellings per acre. And so that's in our comprehensive plan. We have countywide plan policies that kind of work for all.
So the lots get bigger as you go further out.
Which is, I mean, the Vancouver urban growth area, which is the city of Vancouver, Salida, Scanlon Creek, Orchards, Hazel Dell, 7% of our 450,000 population is 300,000 people that live in the Vancouver growth area.
But they aren't in the city of Vancouver, no. Some of the ones you just mentioned. So how does that?
So that's where the county's zoning code applies in that unincorporated area. So the city of Vancouver has their own zoning ordinance for the 160,000 folks in city limits, and the 140,000 that are outside of the city limits but within the Vancouver urban growth area. The idea is that
So who gets to set the rules for the Vancouver urban growth area when it's two different jurisdictions?
There's two different entities. We had a project a couple of years ago to try to sort of have our zoning kind of match a little more, because when areas were being annexed, there was differences between how development was occurring, and so we were working to be consistent, to have sort of similar zoning types, so when that annexation occurred, you'd essentially have similar neighborhoods. Sometimes we can see eye to eye, sometimes we don't. So it's a work in progress.
Okay. All right. Any other questions that people have?
I would just make a comment that the housing subcommittee has been looking at some interesting things that Washington County over across the river has been doing to encourage affordable housing. And of course, part of that includes density issues. And I listened with interest. There was a report on, I believe, Channel 6 about 3 weeks ago now, that apparently the natives are restless in Washington County because, although on paper and with the county trying to really do some things to provide affordable housing, now many of the residents are getting concerned about traffic densities, that kind of thing. So it's a real struggle.
Anything else? Okay, thank you very much, Jose. We appreciate it. And we'll look forward to more discussions as you move forward. Okay, we are going to have Pete Monroe, who is going to be talking about Clark County Community Development Block Grant Program, home investment partnerships, and so on.
Does this work for you?
I don't know. I guess we'll find out. Look at that. He's got his own clicker.
Okay, thank you. If I might add one thing, I was looking at the minutes from your last meeting. The last item, Bob was commenting about a project in Washougal. Mm-hmm. And that's a project that we provided funding to through Affordable Community Environment Space, which is now merged with REACH. And the final closing of the financing on that, although the actual construction is done, is going to occur in the end of October. What I'm going to do is go over our consolidated plan. This is required by HUD to be submitted every 5 years. And it covers the CDBG and home funds that Clark County receives from HUD. The City of Vancouver does a separate consolidated plan. They're on a different timeline than we are. They're doing 14 to 19. This has to be approved by HUD before we can receive our CDBG and home funds. So it's just been approved in July, and we're moving ahead at this point. So let me see here. This doesn't work. I'm going to talk about different income levels, and so I want to show you these. The first one is what's called 30% of the median family income, and you can see at the bottom row for a household of one, that's $14,600. We take it out to a household of five. We have 60%, 80% of the area median income, and then 100%. Generally, what you will find is clients for the Vancouver Housing Authority income cannot exceed the 60% number. Generally, most of their clients are much lower than that. And again, with our home investment partnership program, the income of rental units, or tenants of rental units, cannot exceed the 60% number. If we can do the next slide. Thank you. With the CDBG program, there are eligible activities, but there are also national objectives that we meet. Some of the national objectives are called limited clientele, those with added spouse, elderly, disabled adults, whether it's physical or mental disabled, delivered adults, persons living with AIDS, and migrant farm workers. The other eligible category with CDBG is housing. And again, for CDBG, these are household incomes that are below 80% of the median income. And I want to point out, because people get a little confused, when we talk about housing with the CDBG program, that is not construction of new housing. It's rehabilitation or acquisition of either single family or rental housing. And then the final CDBG national objective is very benefit. And these green areas are areas for we can do the area benefit. They're low high income areas. We don't have Vancouver on there, obviously, but around the county, these are the areas that are shown as low and moderate income. And this is based on data from the American Community Survey that have been massages. So what I'm going to do is spend some time talking about housing, because we have an incredible housing crisis in our county right now. And one of the reasons it's gotten this way is if you look at the median family income according to HUD, from 2010 to 2015, it's gone up almost 4%, while at the same time the fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment has gone up about 13%. So the rents are rising much faster than income, rents are going up faster than inflation, and it's pricing people out of rental housing. One of the other things that are going on here, of course, is rental development basically stopped during the recession, and you have a county that's growing very rapidly. Over the last year, Clark County is the second fastest growing county in the state of Washington, and since 2010, it's the fourth fastest growing county in the state. However, the city of Portland and Baltimore County area is actually growing faster, so there's a push for some of those people trying to move over to Clark County as well. Since 2010, Clark County has had 27,000 new citizens move into the county. If we can see the next slide, please. This shows, and again, this is data from the American Community Survey that HUD has to massage. So what this shows is the income distribution of owner-occupied housing and renter-occupied housing for the two different time periods, 2007 to 2011, and 2008 to 2012. This is the latest data I have from HUD. It takes about a year and a half for them to massage the data for each metropolitan statistical area. So what you can see is that for the owner housing, it's actually decreased the ownership a little bit. And for the rental housing, you can see it's gone up. And it's gone up basically with every income level, whether it's 0 to 30%. Remember, those are very low incomes, all the way up to households with an income above 100% of the area median income. This is an example of what's called low wages and high rents lockout renters of Clark County. First of all, on the left-hand side, you see the wages needed to afford a two-bedroom house or two-bedroom apartment in the metropolitan statistical area, and that's a wage of $18.15 an hour. A full-time minimum wage for a two-bedroom apartment at the fair market rent would require you to work almost 80 hours a week in order to afford it. If you look at the middle part of the graph, you can see the annual area mean income for the metropolitan statistical area is $73,900. 30% of that is $22,170 for this for 2015. And then you see the average two-bedroom fair market rent apartment is $944. The monthly rent at 30% of AMI would be $554. Now, the fair market rents are lagging behind market rate. If you look at a two-bedroom apartment in Clark County now, they're advertised anywhere from about $1,200 to some up to $1,500. So somebody at 30% of their median income cannot afford a market rate apartment. Now I'm going to talk about cost burden, which is a concept that HUD uses, and it's been used by the Department of Commerce in a study of housing in the state of Washington. I'm going to give you an example of it here. If you assume somebody has an income or a household has an income of $1,600 a month, 30% of that income equals $480 per month. So if they can find a rental housing that costs $480 a month, that would be considered affordable. If somebody has an income from the income, 30 to 50% of the income for housing would be $800 a month. This would be a cost burden for somebody that has an income of $1,600 a month. And if you're paying over 50% of your housing, that would be $960 per month. And this would be what I call severe cost burden. And again, if you think of somebody with low income paying more than half their income for housing, it can take a medical issue, car breaks down, doesn't take much, and they're in danger of losing their housing and potentially going into the homeless system. So if we see the next slide. So this shows the cost burden for 2007, 2011, 2008. So if you look in the left-hand column, we have people, this is the lowest income, people with an income less than 30% of their median income. You can see the bottom, I think that's kind of blue, a little color challenge. That's affordable. The next is kind of a red, that's cost burden, that's the cost burden. And then the green is severe cost burden. So you can see while the number of renters with incomes less than 30% has increased between for the period 2007, 2011 compared to 2008, 2012. And you see that a lot of that jump has been severe cost burden, which again are people with the lowest income paying more than 50% of their income for housing. And then if you look, the next one is 30. The next column you can see is for the people with income 31 to 50%. Again, you can see there are a lot of people that are cost burden, but not as many severe cost burden, but again, that population is growing. Then you get to 51 to 80%, there's much more affordability with the blue, less of a severe cost burden. And then you get 81 to 100% and 100% plus. And most of that is affordable for people. There's really no severe cost burden and very little cost burden. And again, this is for renters all over the county. I know you've talked about unincorporated part of Clark County. If you pull that data out, it looks like this. It's just not as big a number. And now we get up the next slide. Thank you. Okay, this is some interesting data that we can pull from the JAS data of HUD, and it shows households by income and also rental units by what they charge, how that would be affordable to income. So if you look at the left-hand side, from the 0 to 30, the first bar on the extreme left is the number of households that have incomes at 0 to 30% of the area median income. And then the bar to the right of that, the darker red one, are the number of rental units that are affordable to people that income range. And clearly there's a shortage, so those people are forced to move into the next income range and so on. And so you can see there's a few more rental units that are affordable at 30 to 50, then there's a lot of units at 50 to 80, and finally there are not as many units at 80% plus. But what that shows you is for people who can't afford, they can't find affordable units if their income is over 30, they're forced to move to higher income or higher rent units if they want to find any rental, and it's causing them to pay more of their income for rent, creating them to be either cost burden or severely cost burden.
Why is that 80 plus? I don't understand that. If you've got people who are making the most, why are they asking?
There are not as many units available to them because most at that point, most people.
Because you're talking about higher end units.
They're living in the home market.
They're buying. Yeah.
If you want to find rental units or rent for, you know, $2,000 a month, you really can't find any. Generally, it might be a really nice private home, okay. Single family home. Next slide, please. This shows the same kind of cost burden for owners, and obviously it's much different because you don't have to have a certain income to own a house. So if you can see, at 0 to 30 for homeowners, there is some cost burden. And obviously, as your income goes up, there's not nearly as much cost for it. This includes not only homeowners that are paying mortgage, but some people who have maybe paid off their mortgage, so obviously they don't have cost for it at that point. But it's a very different picture than what you have for the rental market. Now I'm going to discuss homelessness just a little bit because our consolidated plan has to cover homeless activities as well. This is an example of the sheltered and unsheltered homeless population in Clark County, taken at the point of time, it's January from 2005 to 2014. And you can see that during that time, the sheltered and unsheltered has gone down, mainly due to the addition of government recording surcharge money that we've been able to use to get people into transitional housing and increase the shelter size slightly, and also provide more permanent supportive housing. If you can do the next slide. The 2014 point in time count, just an example of the homeless subpopulations that we've identified, are the homeless people. Chronic homeless individuals take up 9% of the point in time count. Severely mentally ill, 17%. Chronic substance abuse, 8%. Veterans, 7%. And victims of domestic violence, 17%. And many of these people report chronic, some of these symptoms are dual symptoms. A lot of people have severe mental illness as well as chronic substance abuse. 71% of persons in homeless families are children under the age of 18.
72%.
Next slide.
Homeless families with children. That is an amazing factor. That just shocks me.
Contracts, which is one of the issues that Washougal redevelopment efforts in lead-based paint, which is an issue, or other situations through acquisition or rehabilitation. And then finally, we have promote home ownership. This would be low and moderate households, including persons with disability and first-time home buyers. Next slide, please. Under neighborhood sustainability, we have community facilities, and this would be acquiring and or improving community facilities to provide services to low and moderate income people, elderly, with special needs population. We have community infrastructure, which is streets, sidewalks, storm drainage, water, and parks. And again, that's acquire or improve the facilities to create a suitable living environment. And then the final number three is economic vitality and encourage economic vitality through activities to build a diverse economic base, enhancing opportunities for low income persons and financial potential. And then we've already talked about homelessness, so we can just skip that. Now I'm going to show you a couple projects we have ongoing. This is a Freedom's Path in Vancouver. It's on the VA campus. This is 50 units of housing that will be for chronic homeless veterans. 40 of the units will be using HUD-VASH vouchers, and then the other 10 units will be still trying to work out a little bit how that's going to be subsidized. If you could click on the link on the bottom of that, you can see, you should be able to see about 30 seconds of them, a time lapse of the building. You can see how they've got to move around large piles of dirt. Hopefully this will work. Yeah, here we go. Well, can you click on the time lapse on the left hand side under the circle? Right there. Yeah. Why don't we have to try it again? This is from about June. Yep. Large pot of dirt. Again, this project will be completed next summer, and it has tax credits and around major funding. Also, the Veterans Administration gave about $1.8 million. Both the city and the county provide home investment partnership funds to this project. This project could eliminate all the chronic homeless veterans in our county if they get into this housing. If we could see the next slide. This project is Lincoln Place. It's across from Share Shelter. This is 30 units of permanent supportive housing for the chronic homeless. We're going to use a vulnerability assessment tool to determine the most vulnerable homeless, chronic homeless people on the streets, people who could die in the streets, and they will be the first ones to live in this facility. This is unique because it's going to have 24/7 staffing. It will have lots of case management, lots of outreach. Nursing students from the University of Portland will visit the clients at least 2 days a week. It will also have a thermal bed bug room so that all the possessions that go into the building will be put in this room for 2 hours at 140 degrees to kill any of the bed bugs. And again, it's going to be at 1110 West 13th, which is across the street from Share House. And this is under construction right now. It should be open early February. And then the next slide, please.
Will there be families as well as individuals?
There could be families. In all likelihood, it will be individuals because these are going to be chronic homeless that have been on the street for years. This is Isabella Court. It's being developed by Reach. Originally, the land was purchased by Ace and then it's been absorbed into Reach. It's on 62nd Avenue off 4th Plain and Flag Lot. It's on a wetland. It's going to be filled in. And this is going to be 45 units of low income senior housing. There'll be studio, one bedroom, and two bedroom units. And they're going to be again renting to seniors at less than 60% of their AMB income. The financing should be finished in October and construction will start in October or November.
This is only for independent living?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is one that Karen and I were very involved with all the way through the process. Ensuring accessibility and a whole lot of other things also. So we're very excited about this one.
One of the requirements, because there are home funds in this, both from the city and the county, that 5% of the units have to be accessible for the physically disabled, and additional 2% for the sensory disabled. So you're going to have at least a minimum of 7% of the units, and they're going to go higher than that. They're going to use some universal design as well.
Yeah, we work very closely with them, so we're very excited about this one.
And then the final slide, if you want to see our full consolidated plan, it's on the document section of our website. The unfortunate thing about the plan for this period is we have to follow a HUD formatting to it. It's not really user-friendly. It's a little hard to look through, and you have to follow the HUD requirements, and not a lot of graphs in there. There are some tables, and I apologize for that. At one time, we were going to make a public version of it. It's more graphic in detail, less text, and we just haven't had the time and the staffing to do that yet. Okay, thank you.
I think it's fair to say that you've shown some crisis here.
Yeah.
What is 2025 and 2030 numbers going to look like?
Part of this is there's a shortage. If you look at just the 0 to 30% of the renters, there's a shortage of about 6,000 units just for that income group alone. It's going to take an incredible amount of production, and money's not available. The housing trust fund hasn't been around, and it's back now with the recession. It just didn't exist. At the federal level, the home program is proposed by the Senate Appropriations Committee. It's kept by 93%, which means the county would pay about $28,000. Probably wouldn't take it because it would be required to just take that small amount.
Your budget needs to what, triple?
Yeah.
Oh. At least.
At least.
Do we have questions from people who are in the visitors today that you'd like to ask? Joe.
I'm so frustrated, I'm going to start. You people are facing serious problems here. And I've told you this before. There's nothing new with the housing problems. There's nothing new with financing. There's a lot of stuff going on. This county that nobody's even talking about. A lot of bad stuff going on. There's millions of dollars being wasted and nobody's talking about it. The money that's being wasted in helping Asian people. I can give you some examples. 40 units, Washougal, rehab, what they do there. They tear the siding down, they put in new siding, they put in new appliances. They do all kinds of stuff to rehab the buildings. 40 units, $7 million. Now that may not sound like a lot, but that's $175,000 a unit. They didn't even have to buy a lot. Now this is the money that the government is spending and wasting in housing. And there's a lot of it. That's only one example that I'm giving you here. Now if you educate, what they're doing is they're moving the people out of the old units, finding them a place to live, paying their rent, and all that adds up to $7 million. If they would have gave those people $10,000 each, they get them out of there and just move out and go out and find your own place somewhere else, it would have been a lot cheaper, and they probably would have got back on their feet. I'm all in favor of helping people. I've never been against this. I made a lot of several multi-million dollar pledge donations based on a program that I had that can generate hundreds of millions of dollars. I went to a meeting this morning with the county councilors, and I told them basically some of the stuff I'm talking to now. With what I know so far, I think I have enough information to go to the grand jury with it. It's not just, and I'm not complaining about what you're doing, I'm not complaining about what Mayor Tim Levin is doing. He's aware of the problem. He brought in a task force. Half the people in that task force are responsible for the economy the way it is. And I'm talking about landlords. The landlords are not going to complain. The homeowners are not going to complain. I got a list here. I get kind of nervous.
Well, do you have a question for either of these guys?
Well, there's a better way to do it. And we're not doing it, but I appreciate what you guys are trying to do, because someone's got to think about these old people. And I'm glad that you guys are doing that. But don't listen to these experts. Somebody was talking about a house there that you looked at 2,600 feet for $600,000. That's a bunch of baloney. That's a waste of money. Too much money to be wasted in construction right now. And we're living in a manufactured economy, and if we can't see that, something's wrong with the way we're thinking.
Okay.
And, you know, I can spend hours talking about
this. Okay, Joe, thank you.
But I'm looking for solutions. I'm the same boat. Hey, I'm getting up there, too.
All right.
And, you know, other than that, I appreciate you guys trying to do.
Thank you. Any other questions anybody has? Anybody? Okay, what else do we have that we need to be doing?
I would really like to say thank you. Great presentation, both of you guys.
Right.
Yes.
I would really like to say thank you.
Thank you for your time and your input. We stand adjourned.
Or sit adjourned, in case maybe.
Or stand.